Chapter 18. Mood was for Correggio and Fragonard, the laughter of the music lesson, and the bold pagan joys of the Antiope, and then he had missed her from his side, and when he came to where she stood, forgetting him, forgetting everything, had seen the glare of that tragic sky in her face, her trembling lip, the tears on her lashes. That was Susie. Closing his book, he stole a glance at Coral Hicks' profile, thrown back against the cushions of the deck chair at his side. There was something harsh and bracing in her blunt primitive build, in the projection of the black eyebrows that nearly met over her thick straight nose, and the faint barely visible black down on her upper lip. Some miracle of willpower, combined with all the artifices that wealth can buy, had turned the fat sallow girl he remembered into this commanding young woman, almost handsome at times, indisputably handsome in her big authoritative way. Watching the arrogant lines of her profile against the blue sea, he remembered, with a thrill that was sweet to his vanity, how twice under the dome of the Scalzi, and in the streets of Genoa he had seen those same lines soften at his approach, turn womanly, pleading and almost humble. That was Coral. Dot, suddenly she said, without turning toward him. You've had no letter since you've been on board. He looked at her, surprised. Oh, thank the Lord. He laughed. And you haven't written one either, she continued in her hard statistical tone. No, he again agreed, with the same laugh. That means that you really are free, free? He saw the cheek nearest him redden. Ely off on a holiday, I mean, not tied down. After a pause he rejoined. Oh, I'm not particularly tied down. And your book? Oh, my book, he stopped and considered. He had thrust the Pageant of Alexander into his handbag on the night of his flight from Venice, but since then he had never looked at it. Too many memories and illusions were pressed between its pages, and he knew just at what page he had felt Ellie Vanderlyn bending over him from behind, caught a whiff of her scent, and heard her breathless add to thank you. My book's hung up, he said impatiently, annoyed with Miss Hicks' lack of tact. There was a girl who never put out feelers. Dot, yes, I thought it was, she went on quietly, and he gave her a startled glance. What the devil else did she think, he wondered. He had never supposed her capable of getting far enough out of her own thick carapace of self-sufficiency to penetrate into anyone else's feelings. The truth is, he continued, embarrassed, I suppose I dug away at it rather too continuously. That's probably why I felt the need of a change. You see, I'm only a beginner. She still continued her relentless questioning. But later you'll go on with it, of course? Oh, I don't know. He paused, glanced down the glittering deck, and then out across the glittering water. I've been dreaming dreams, you see. I rather think I shall have to drop the book altogether, and try to look out for a job that will pay. To indulge in my kind of literature, one must first have an assured income. He was instantly annoyed with himself for having spoken. Hitherto in his relations with the Hickses he had carefully avoided the least allusion that might make him feel the heavy hand of their beneficence. But the idle procrastinating weeks had weakened him, and he had yielded to the need of putting into words his vague intentions. To do so would perhaps help to make them more definite. To his relief, Miss Hicks made no immediate reply, and when she spoke it was in a softer voice, and with an unwonted hesitation. It seems a shame that with gifts like yours you shouldn't find some kind of employment that would leave you leisure enough to do your real work. Dot dot dot. He shrugged ironically. As there are a goodish number of us hunting for that particular kind of employment. Her tone became more businesslike. No, it's hard to find, almost impossible. But would you take it, I wonder, if it were offered to you? She turned her head slightly, and their eyes met. For an instant, blank terror loomed upon him. But before he had time to face it, she continued, in the same untroubled voice. Mr. Buddle's place, I mean. My parents must absolutely have someone they can count on. You know what an easy place it is. I think you would find the salary satisfactory. Nick drew a deep breath of relief. For a moment her eyes had looked as they had in the Skal's eye, and he liked the girl too much not to shrink from reawakening that look. But Mr. Buttles' place? Why not? Poor Buttles, he murmured. To guy in time. Oh, she said, you won't find the same reasons as he did for throwing up the job. He was the martyr of his artistic convictions. He glanced at her sideways, wondering. After all, she did not know of his meeting with Mr. Buttles in Genoa, nor of the latter's confidences. Perhaps she did not even know of Mr. Buttles' hopeless passion. At any rate, her face remained calm. Why not consider it at least just for a few months? Till after our expedition to Mesopotamia, she pressed on, a little breathlessly. You're awfully kind. But I don't know, she stood up with one of her abrupt movements. You need, all at once. Take time, think it over. Father wanted me to ask you, she appended. He felt the inadequacy of his response. Tea tempts me awfully, of course. But I must wait, at any rate wait for letters. The fact is I shall have to wire from Rhodes two of them sent. I had chucked everything, even letters, for a few weeks. Ah, you are tired, she murmured, giving him a last downward glance as she turned away. Greater than from Rhodes, Nick Lansing telegraphed to his Paris bank to send his letters to Candia. But when the Ibis reached Candia, and the mail was brought on board, the thick envelope handed to him contained no letter from Susie. Why should it, since he had not yet written to her? He had not written, no. But in sending his address to the bank he knew he had given her the opportunity of reaching him, if she wished to. And as he had made no sign. Late that afternoon, when they returned to the yacht from their first expedition, a packet of newspapers lay on the deckhouse table. Nick picked up one of the London journals, and his eye ran absently down the list of social events. He read, among the visitors expected next week at Ruin Castle, let for the season to Mr. Frederick J. Gillow of New York, our Prince Altenari of Rome, the Earl of Altringham and Mrs. Nicholas Lansing, who arrived in London last week from Paris. And Nick threw down the paper. It was just a month since he had left the Palazzo Vanderlyn and flung himself into the night express for Milan. A whole month and Susie had not written. Only a month and Susie and Strefford were already together. XVII, Susie had decided to wait for Strefford in London. The new Lord Altringham was with his family in the north, and though she found a telegram on arriving, saying that he would join her in town the following week, as he had still an interval of several days to fill. London was a desert. The rain fell without ceasing, and alone in the shabby family hotel which, even out of season, was the best she could afford, she sat at last face to face with herself. Greater than from the moment when Violet Melrose had failed to carry out her plan for the Fulmer children, her interest in Susie had visibly waned. Often before, in the old days, Susie Branch had felt the same abrupt change of temperature in the manner of the hostess of the moment. And often how often had yielded, and performed the required service, rather than risk the consequences of estrangement. To that, at least, thank heaven, she need never stoop again. But as she hurriedly packed her trunks at Versailles, scraped together an adequate tip for Mrs. Match, and bade goodbye to Violet, grown suddenly fond and demonstrative as she saw her visitor safely headed for the station, as Susie went through the old familiar mummery of the enforced leave-taking, there rose in her so deep a disgust for the life of makeshifts and accommodations, that if at that moment Nick had reappeared and held out his arms to her, she was not sure she would have had the courage to return to them. In her London solitude the thirst for independence grew fiercer. Independence with ease, of course. Oh, her hateful useless love of beauty. The curse it had always been to her, the blessing it might have been if only as he had had the material means to gratify, and to express it. And instead, it only gave her a morbid loathing of that hideous hotel bedroom drowned in yellow rain light, of the smell of soot and cabbage through the window, the blistered wallpaper, the moldy wax bouquets under glass globes, and the electric lighting so contrived that as you turned on the feeble globe hanging from the middle of the ceiling, the feebler one beside the bed went out. What a sham world she and Nick had lived in during their few months together. What right had either of them to those exquisite settings of the life of leisure? The long white house hidden in camellias and cypresses above the lake, or the great rooms on the Giudecca with the shimmer of the canal always playing over their frescoed ceilings. Yet as he had come to imagine that these places really belonged to them, that they would always go on living, fondly and irreproachably, in the frame of other people's wealth. Dot, that, again, was the curse of her love of beauty, the way she always took to it, as if it belonged to her. Well, the awakening was bound to come, and it was perhaps better that it should have come so soon. At any rate, there was no use in letting her thoughts wander back to that shattered fool's paradise of theirs. Only, as she sat there and reckoned up the days till Strefford arrived, what else in the world was there to think of? Her future and his? But she knew that future by heart already. As he had not spent her life among the rich and fashionable without having learned every detail of the trappings of a rich and fashionable marriage. As he had calculated long ago just how many dinner dresses, how many tea gowns, and how much lacy lingerie would go to make up the outfit of the future Countess of Altringham. She had even decided to which dressmaker she would go for her chinchilla cloak, for she meant to have one, and down to her feet, and softer and more voluminous and more extravagantly sumptuous than Violet's or Ursula's. Not to speak of silver foxes and sables. Nor yet of the Altringham jewels. She knew all this by heart, had always known it. It all belonged to the makeup of the life of elegance. There was nothing new about it. What had been new to her was just that short interval with Nick, a life unreal indeed in its setting, but so real in its essentials. The one reality as he had ever known. As she looked back on it, she saw how much it had given her besides the golden flush of her happiness, the sudden flowering of sensuous joy in heart and body. Yes, there had been the flowering too, in pain-like birth pangs, of something graver, stronger, fuller of future power, something as he had hardly heeded in her first light rapture, but that always came back, and possessed her stilled soul when the rapture sank. The deep disquieting sense of something that Nick and love had taught her, but that reached out even beyond love and beyond Nick. Her nerves were racked by the ceaseless swish, swish of the rain on the dirty panes, and the smell of cabbage and coal that came in under the door when she shut the window. This nauseating foretaste of the luncheon she must presently go down to was more than she could bear. It brought with it a vision of the dank coffee room below, the sooty Smyrna rug, the rain on the skylight, the listless waitresses handing about food that tasted as if it had been rained onto. There was really no reason why she should let such material miseries add to her depression. Dot, she sprang up, put on her hat and jacket, and calling for a taxi drove to the London branch of the Nouveau Luxe Hotel. It was just 1 o'clock, and she was sure to pick up a luncheon, for though London was empty, that great establishment was not. It never was. Along those sultry velvet-carpeted halls, in that great flowered and scented dining room, there was always a come and go of rich aimless people, the busy people who, having nothing to do, perpetually pursue their inexorable task from one end of the earth to the other. Oh, the monotony of those faces, the faces one always knew, whether one knew the people they belonged to or not. A fresh disgust seized her at the sight of them. She wavered, and then turned and fled. But on the threshold a still more familiar figure met her. That of a lady in exaggerated pearls and sables, descending from an exaggerated motor, like the motors in magazine advertisements, the huge arcs in which jeweled beauties and slender youths pause to gaze at snow peaks from an alpine summit. It was Ursula Gillow, dear old Ursula, on her way to Scotland, and she and Susie fell on each other's necks. It appeared that Ursula, detained till the next evening by a dressmaker's delay, was also out of a job and killing time, and the two were soon smiling at each other over the exquisite preliminaries of a luncheon which the head waiter had authoritatively asked Mrs. Gillow to heave to him, as usual. Ursula was in a good humor. It did not often happen, but when it did, her benevolence knew no bounds. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.